From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons, about how some of the characters and storylines were developed. He's the guest editor of the new book, Best Music Writing of 2003. Also, the origin of the Serenity Prayer, the prayer adopted by AA, which asks for the grace to accept what can't be changed and the courage to change what should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish one from the other. The prayer is popular around the world, but few people know its origins. It was written in 1943 by the American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. We'll talk with his daughter, publisher and editor Elizabeth Sifton. Her new book tells the story behind the prayer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The International Donors Conference for Iraq's Reconstruction opened today in Madrid. Bush administration officials sounded upbeat, though they refused to put a dollar figure on what they expected from other countries. James Wolfensohn, president of the World Bank, said countries might be willing to contribute but are concerned about security.
I think they may indicate that they will give money. But I don't think physically it's going to be possible to get in and do a lot of the work if there's a real chance that your people will be killed.
The External Affairs Commissioner for the European Union said expectations shouldn't be too high. He said it shouldn't be assumed that European taxpayers who opposed the Iraq war will want to pledge large amounts to reconstruction. Federal officials say at least 300 illegal workers who clean Walmart stores around the country have been arrested in a nationwide crackdown. Bill Siebel with member station KERA in Dallas has more.
Dubbed Operation Rollback by government officials, the investigation of overnight cleanup crews working for outside contractors netted undocumented workers in 21 states. More than 10% of them were arrested in Texas, including 11 people in Dallas. Walmart officials said they were cooperating with authorities and that cleanup crews didn't work for Walmart per se, but independent contractors. Mostly Eastern Europeans were employed, while some came from Mexico. But U.S. officials said executives with the discount retailing giant knew about the illegal hiring of work crews and were complicit in the contractor's scheme. Some Walmart executives have been subpoenaed to tell what they know. Arrests occurred at 60 Walmart stores. For NPR News, I'm Bill Siebel in Dallas.
As many as 31 soldiers serving in the Gulf in the past year have been infected with a severe parasitic skin infection that is endemic to the region. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has evaluated 22 cases of military personnel infected with cutaneous leishmaniasis, a skin infection that is caused by the bite of the sandfly. Only 2% of the flies, however, carry the parasite that causes the infection. Leishmaniasis can go undetected for months before skin lesions caused by the infection are noticed. Left untreated, the infection can lead to chronic lesions, wasting, and anemia. So healthcare workers are being advised to check whether people with persistent skin lesions and fevers have served in Iraq or Afghanistan. There are no reports of leishmaniasis being transmitted by transfusions in the U.S., but as a precautionary measure, no person who has served in Iraq can donate blood for 12 months after having left the region. Brenda Wilson, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials finished up 14 points at 96.13. Trading was heavy, almost 1.6 billion shares. Losing issues outpaced winners 16-15 on the big board. The Nasdaq closed down 12 points today at 18.85. The Standard & Poor's 500 was up 3 at 10.33. This is NPR News. Senate Democrats today set conditions for their support of a Medicare prescription drug bill. They objected strongly to proposals backed by conservative Republicans for spending caps and for having Medicare compete directly with privately managed health care plans. Democrats say that that could cause traditional Medicare premiums to skyrocket. A letter to President Bush, signed by 41 senators, 39 of them Democrats, says any agreement that jeopardizes Medicare and does not provide meaningful assistance to the elderly and disabled should not and will not pass. Russia has temporarily halted construction of a controversial dam which had set off a border dispute with neighbor Ukraine. NPR's Lawrence Sheets reports from Moscow.
Russian engineers had been constructing a land bridge towards a Ukrainian-claimed island in the Sea of Azov. The Russians said the barrier was to stop high waves from flooding Russian coastal villages nearby. But Ukraine sees the earthen barrier, which came within just a few hundred yards of tiny, windswept Tuzla Island, as a threat to its sovereignty. Ukrainian President Leonid Kuchma this week cut short a visit to Latin America in order to deal with what some have described as the worst crisis in relations with Russia since the breakup of the Soviet Union. Ukrainian troops put on a show of strength by erecting a makeshift sea border near the island. The country's lawmakers called for international mediation. Russian officials say work has been stopped on the dam while officials from the two countries hold talks over the dispute. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Moscow.
It's Game 5 of the World Series tonight in Miami. The New York Yankees are tied 2-2 with Florida Marlins, who won last night's game in the 12th inning. Brad Penny pitches for Florida, David Wells for New York tonight. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces I Heard It on NPR, Shake These Blues, a compilation of blues tracks by musicians featured on NPR programs at npr.org.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Dow Osman's The Stones of Summer, inspiration for the film Stone Reader, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com, and from DK Publishing, publishers of Smithsonian Institution The Story of the West, a history of the American West and its people.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It may be the funniest show on television, it may be the best cultural satire on television, and it's changed the course of TV animation. I'm talking about The Simpsons. My guest is the show's creator, Matt Groening. He also created the animated series Futurama, and he draws the syndicated comic strip Life in Hell. Groening is also the guest editor of the new book, Best Music Writing of 2003. It's part of an annual series collecting the finest writing on rock, pop, jazz, country, and more, published by DiCapo. We'll talk about the book and about some of the music Matt Groening loves in a few days in part two of our interview. Today, the subject is The Simpsons. Let's start with a clip. In this episode, Krusty the Clown has been invited to the Simpson house for dinner.
Who wants to say grace?
Why don't we let our guests do it?
Krusty, would you do the honors?
Well, all right. I'm a little rusty, but I'll try. Baruch ata Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, hamotzi lechem min haaretz.
Oh, he's talking funny talk.
No, Dad, that's Hebrew. Krusty must be Jewish.
A Jewish entertainer? Get out of here.
Dad, there are many prominent Jewish entertainers, including Lauren Bacall, Don Shore, William Shatner, and Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks is Jewish?
I want to ask you about some of the characters that didn't exist in the very beginning stages of The Simpsons, starting with Krusty the Clown, who's this really funny character. I mean, he's basically like an old vaudevillian type. He's, you know, really bitter and Jewish, like a lot of comics, and but this is like an old style Jewish comic dash clown. What did you think of Krusty when he was first created?
Well, Krusty was based on a TV show clown who I grew up with in Portland, Oregon, named Rusty Nails. Rusty Nails was a Christian clown. He was he had his own show, and he showed old Three Stooges shorts, and he was great. And he wasn't like Krusty at all. He was very nice guy, and a very sweet clown. But he had that name, Rusty Nails, which I found incredibly disturbing as a child, because you're supposed to avoid Rusty Nails, so. So the idea of a clown named Rusty Nails.
You were a sensitive little kid.
Clowns are scary to begin with. And even though this was a nice clown, I was slightly perturbed by him. Anyway, so Krusty the Clown, Krusty rhymes with Rusty, and I actually created him as a little on-screen character on the Tracy Ullman show for those little shorts there. And the idea of the design of him is he actually is basically originally Homer in clown garb, and the satirical conceit that I was going for at the time was that the Simpsons was about a kid who had no respect for his father but worshipped a clown who looked exactly like his father. So but we sort of lost that, and I didn't make Krusty Jewish. That was Jay Kogan and Wally Walidarsky, I think, came up with that idea, two of the old Simpsons writers. And then the rest is, you know, it's sort of, it's just, he's one of the richest characters on the show. In fact, this year we have Krusty having his bar mitzvah, finally. Turns out he... And it's a pretty wild show.
I love it when his father was played by Jackie Mason.
Yep, Jackie Mason is coming back.
Oh, great. Yes, great piece of role.
Playing Rabbi Krestovsky, Krusty's father.
You know, we spoke just as The Simpsons was becoming coming into existence, starting first as a Tracy Ullman series. And I think we spoke just as it was about to be broadcast on its own. And a lot has happened since then. Simpsons have taken over the world since then. I'm wondering how your vision of the characters as they are now compare with the vision you had when you were creating them.
Well, here's the problem with doing a sitcom which has lasted more than 300 episodes is you're trying not to repeat yourself. You're trying to surprise the audience, and you're trying to keep everybody works on the show surprised. As a result, the show has gone off in some very peculiar directions. Sometimes I was alarmed. I was going, oh, my God, we can't do this. We can't do this. And then it turns out to be okay. It's funny. It's crazy. And it's the show is so fast-paced. We learned as we went along that we can cram a lot of jokes in there. So if there's a joke you don't like, just wait fraction of a second, and there'll be another one to come along to replace it.
You said that there were things to which you said, we can't do this. What's an example of that?
Oh, we've done the Simpsons Bible stories, and I just thought, you know, we're just sticking our chins out and asking for trouble. And we've done a lot of, as the culture has shifted, because when the show started, when they first started, it was 1987, and here it is 2003, the culture has gotten coarser, and so the jokes in The Simpsons are a little more extreme, I think, to keep up with the times. And it wasn't originally to my taste. And you want to keep the same tone that we had from the very beginning. And everybody's adding their own 2 cents. And luckily, we all are facing the same direction. So there's if something's really, really weird and crazy, everybody fights against it. And the show, it takes 6 months to do a single episode, so there's lots of chances to fight for your joke or fight for something that's off character. One of the great things we did last year was we parodied the Fox News Channel, and we did the crawl along the bottom of the screen. Uh-huh. And Fox fought against it and said that they would sue. They would sue the show. And we called their bluff, because we didn't think Rupert Murdoch would pay for Fox to sue itself. So we got away with it. But now Fox has a new rule that we can't do those little fake news crawls on the bottom of the screen in a cartoon, because it might confuse the viewers into thinking it's real news.
What are some of the other things that you have been threatened legally over, or, you know, that have been really controversial, advertisers pulling out? Because let's face it, The Simpsons does a lot of satire about homosexuality, the church, you know, violence on television.
At the beginning, virtually anything we did would get somebody upset. And now it seems like the people who are eager to be offended, and this country is full of people who are eager to be offended, they've given up on our show. We got into trouble a few years ago for Homer's watching an anti-drinking commercial, and it said, warning, beer causes rectal cancer. And Homer responds by saying, beer. Fox didn't want us to do that, because beer advertisers are a big part of the Fox empire, and it turns out that the writer was able to track down the actual fact where some study showed that indeed it does, or did, or has a tendency to. So we were able to keep that in. But they want that's the kind of thing we put up with.
Let's talk about Itchy and Scratchy. And this is the recurring cartoon that Bart and Lisa watch on TV. And it's the kind of like super violent version of all the cat and mouse kind of cartoons. How'd you come up with this?
Well, it was from watching cat and mouse cartoons growing up. Pixie and Dixie, the Hanna-Barbera mice, and Tom and Jerry in particular. Very, very violent and very, very funny cartoons, MGM cartoons. And with the fantasy was seeing, you know, wanting these cartoons to extend their violence even more. And so with Itchy and Scratchy, it's as it's probably as extreme as it can get for a cat and mouse cartoon. And it's been really fun, because it turns out the way these shows come together, that whatever the theme of that particular episode is of The Simpsons, there's some Itchy and Scratchy cartoon that obliquely relates to it. They're very hard to write now. We've done so many of them that they're harder and harder to write. And originally, of the actors, Harry Shearer, a sophisticated guy, he seemed to laugh the hardest at Itchy and Scratchy during the table reads. I don't know if he's the voice of Itchy or Scratchy, but he's the voice of one of them. He talks like that. Dan Castellaneta is the voice of the other one, the cat or the mouse. I don't know. I sometimes have difficulty remembering which is the cat. And then I go, oh, Scratchy, because he scratches. That's how I figure it out.
So were you in on the writing of the Itchy and Scratchy theme song?
That was obvious. It's by the way, it's not, everybody thinks it's they fight and fight and fight and fight and fight. It's not. It's they fight and bite and fight and fight and bite.
Well, I think it's time to hear the Itchy and Scratchy theme song. Let's hear it. That's the Itchy and Scratchy theme song from The Simpsons. My guest Matt Groening created The Simpsons. He also just edited the new book, The DiCapo Best Music Writing Anthology of 2003, a collection of the best music writing of the year, as selected by Matt Groening. Yeah.
The lyrics to that were written by Sam Simon, one of the original producers who developed the show, along with Jim Brooks, and basically set the tone for the show.
One of the characters is Ned Flanders. He's the Simpsons' born-again neighbor. And, you know, so the kids in the Flanders household are being brought up very differently than the kids in the Simpsons household. Can you talk about the creation of Ned Flanders?
Originally, Ned Flanders was just the wacky neighbor who was supposed to be just a complete annoyance to Homer for no good reason. And then we realized that he was an object of mirth with his strong religious feelings. We thought, how do we create a religious character who is not the usual stereotype? And we made him a truly good guy. And his beliefs are sometimes a little annoying, but he's not a hypocrite. He's real, and we get lots of fan mail for him. And we get lots of photos of people who look exactly like Ned Flanders. Some people think Michael Medved is a Ned Flanders clone. So,
because he looks,
and I love the character. Harry Shearer does the voice, and he does such a fantastic job with finding variations on Oakley Dokley, and I think we treat the character with some dignity.
Matt Groening is the creator of The Simpsons. He's the guest editor of the new book, Best Music Writing of 2003. We'll talk with Groening about the book and music in part two of our interview sometime in the next few days. Here's another scene from The Simpsons. Homer is visiting the Flanders house.
Hey, Dad, thanks for helping me with my science project.
Oh, my pleasure, study buddy.
Aw, I got the best dad in the whole world.
Oh, now you know how that embarrasses me.
I know. Toodly doodly.
Kids can be a trial sometimes.
All right, knock it off!
Knock what off, Simpson?
You've been rubbing my nose in it since I got here. Your family is better than my family. Your beer comes from farther away than my beer. You and your son like each other. Your wife's butt is higher than my wife's butt. You make me sick!
Simpson, I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave. I hope you understand.
I wouldn't stay on a bet! On for the road.
This is Fresh Air. Sure, we're public radio, but that doesn't stop us from enjoying great commercial broadcasting, like The Simpsons, and we enjoy having on the people who create it. But I ask you now to take inspiration from Homer, who once pledged to public television. Okay, he reneged on that pledge, but Homer always falls a little short in the role model category. Please call now. Thank you. Two years before British TV writer Dennis Potter died in 1994, he wrote his own movie-length adaptation of his 1986 miniseries, The Singing Detective. Now that movie has finally been made, and our TV critic David Bianculli considers the wisdom of making it in the first place.
Usually, I let these TV-to-movie adaptations go without weighing in. You didn't hear me complaining about how Eddie Murphy ruined the spirit of I Spy, or how Will Smith couldn't even get the Wild Wild West right, or how Uma Thurman was all wrong as Emma Peel in The Avengers. Usually, when movie studios remake a TV title, it's because that title is just about all it cares about. It's a pre-sold entity, and easier to produce and promote than something generated from scratch. But The Singing Detective isn't just any old TV show. Dennis Potter's multi-layered miniseries was a masterpiece. At the time, I called it the best drama I'd ever seen that was written expressly for television. Almost two decades later, I still feel the same way. In the original miniseries, it's the story of a pulp fiction writer named Marlowe, played by Michael Gambon, who's been hospitalized with a crippling, recurring skin condition. The key to his disease, it turns out, is in his mind and in his past. A psychologist works with Marlowe, and often against him, to unlock his memories and traumas in hopes of returning him to health. Meanwhile, the medications Marlowe is taking are making him hallucinate, often with period music from his childhood, and also making him paranoid. To keep from going insane, Marlowe tries to rewrite, in his head, one of his old novels, The Singing Detective, into a screenplay. He casts a healthy version of himself in the lead and dictates to himself the film noir action and Philip Chandlerish narration as he imagines it.
The doorman of a nightclub can always pretend that it's lipstick and not blood on his hands. But how did it get there? Let's be economical, nothing fancy. If he'd smack some dame across her shiny mug, then he's got both answers in one.
But even as Marlowe is rewriting his book in his mind and his paranoia are getting the better of him. He fears his wife is conspiring against him to find and sell his screenplay out from under him. Before long, characters from his book and events from his past are echoing in what he thinks is real life, and all the plot threads become intertwined. I know, it sounds almost ridiculously confusing. But that's the point. When it was shown here on public television, it took more than 2 hours into The Singing Detective before all those threads and mysterious flashback images revealed themselves and made sense. At 2 hours, the miniseries was just getting started. In the movies, by the time you hit the two-hour mark, The Singing Detective is over. There are times, and this certainly was one of them, when television can do something better than the movies. When a miniseries is done properly, it allows for the sort of subtext, slow character development, and patient pace that film, in most cases, refuses to take the time to provide. Think of the very best miniseries, like the Western Lonesome Dove, or the full-length TV version of the Royal Shakespeare Company's Life and Adventures of Nicholas Nickleby. And you have to agree that their length also is their strength. Even with Potter cutting and rewriting his own material, no two-hour version of The Singing Detective could satisfy like the full-length seven-hour version. This movie, though, doesn't come close. Not only does it cut some of the best characterization and texture by putting the patient, here named Dan Dark and played by Robert Downey Jr., in isolation. But it also shifts the musical period to the 1950s, which takes away the psychological reason for its importance. Singing old dancehall songs at the local pub was the only pleasure Marlowe's dad ever knew. It also just doesn't match the film noir atmosphere. In the original, when Marlowe imagined his doctors singing about his troubles, the song was the very appropriate Dry Bones. In this remake, it's a meaningless At the Hop. The casting, I have fewer problems with. Robert Downey Jr. isn't as good in the first hour when his character is bedridden and almost frozen solid. It's only when Dan Dark's skin condition begins to clear up that Downey begins to shine. But from then on, he's good, and the rest of the cast is very satisfying. Robin Wright Penn as his wife and Carla Gugino as his mother all have multiple roles in Dark's twisted imagination, and they shift and mutate accordingly. Adrian Brody, who just won an Oscar, is in here too, and John Polito and Alfre Woodard. What little they're given to do, they do well. Mel Gibson as the psychologist is a good role and a good performance, but the incredibly tense wordplay of the original, like everything else in this movie, isn't delivered as compellingly here.
Word games?
Yeah, sure, I throw you a word.
I come back with another word.
Yeah, that you associate with the word that I, you know.
Okay, wait, yeah, but we gotta agree in advance that it's meaningless. Right, oh. Please, there's no diagnostic value. Really.
Fine.
Promiscuity.
Free.
Gift.
Giver.
Sucker.
Mouth.
Fangs.
Wolf.
Whistle.
Scream.
Silence.
Young.
Green.
Old.
Mick Jagger.
Years ago, Dennis Potter adapted another of his wonderful miniseries, Pennies from Heaven, into a movie starring Steve Martin. In that one, the main mistake was glamorizing the musical fantasy sequences. In The Singing Detective, director Keith Gordon's chief mistake is going with Potter's concept of Americanizing the setting and modernizing the music. The Singing Detective was perfect just the way it was. And since you can see it the way it was by buying or renting the DVD set, there's as little point in watching this movie version as there was in making it. As Marlowe, and now Dan Dark, would say, am I right or am I right?
David Bianculli reviews TV for Fresh Air and the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's music from the Singing Detective TV miniseries.
Barbiturate. Antidepressants.
Valium. And Librium.
Ezekiel cried.
Dry bones.
Ezekiel cried.
Dry bones.
Ezekiel cried.
Dry bones. Now hear the word of the Lord. Ezekiel connected them. Dry bones. Ezekiel connected them. Dry bones. Ezekiel connected them. Dry bones. Now hear the word of the Lord. Oh, when your toe bone connected to your foot bone connected to you. Heel bone, your heel bone connected to you. Ankle bone connected to you. Leg bone connected to you. Knee bone connected to you. Thigh bone connected to you. Hip bone connected to you. Back bone connected to you. Shoulder bone connected to you. Your neck bone connected to you. Head bone, now hear the word of the Lord. Them bones gonna walk around them.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the story behind the Serenity Prayer, the prayer that was adopted by AA and has become popular around the world. It was written in 1943 by the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. We'll talk with his daughter, Elizabeth Sifton, author of the new book, The Serenity Prayer.
Thank you.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the Internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Rodale Incorporated, publishers of Not Fade Away, A Short Life Well Lived by Lawrence Shames and Peter Barton. The book tells the story of Barton's maverick life and unique response to dying young at bookstores everywhere.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Serenity Prayer, the prayer adapted by Alcoholics Anonymous, which we'll hear in a moment, is known around the world, but few people know its origins. It was written at the height of World War II by the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, who passionately opposed Hitler. Niebuhr is the author of the books Moral Man and Immoral Society and The Nature and Destiny of Man, which have been studied by many students of theology. My guest is Niebuhr's daughter, Elizabeth Sifton. She's written a new book called The Serenity Prayer that tells the story behind the prayer and discusses her late father's view of faith and politics in times of peace and war. Sifton is a senior vice president of the publishing company Farrar, Straus & Giroux. She's worked in publishing for 40 years, but this is her first time out as an author. Let's start with the Serenity Prayer.
God, give us grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, courage to change the things that should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other.
Elizabeth Sifton, I've always really liked that prayer. I had no idea your father wrote it. I guess most people don't know your father wrote it.
Most people don't know. Many people think other people wrote it, or that it's so old that the origins are lost in the mists of time. He composed it in 1943 for a little village church in northwestern Massachusetts where he spent the summers.
One of the things I've always liked about that prayer is that there are things where I just can't tell if it's something that can be changed or if it's something I must learn to accept. And that gray area between what can be changed and what can't be changed has created considerable anguish in my life over the years.
Well, exactly so. And it does for, I think, all of us or anybody who has any care for the meaning of their lives. That's the condition that's addressed in the third part of the prayer, a prayer for wisdom to distinguish what can be changed from, or what should be changed from what cannot be changed. I think my father felt, and he was a social activist and a very deeply committed Christian believer in trying to strive for social justice and improvement in ordinary people's lives, I think he felt that all too often people settled for the status quo thinking it couldn't be changed and did not give real thought to the possibility that it should be. He meant that as a personal thing, as you've mentioned. It's a matter of personal striving, but it's also a matter of social engagement and community care as well. The prayer became famous because shortly after it was written, it was composed, I should say. I don't exactly know how he scribbled it down. Prayers were very often for him simply spoken in a church service. But shortly after he had composed it, a friend of his, and also a person who attended this same small church in Massachusetts in the summer, Dean Howard Robbins of the National Cathedral in Washington, who was a big shot in the Federal Council of Churches, asked if he could use the prayer in a small pamphlet that was being prepared for use in the army. And so my father said, sure, use it for that. So the first published appearance of the prayer was in a little booklet prepared for servicemen in Europe. I met many soldiers in World War II who came to Union Theological Seminary, where my father taught in New York City, who became students of his after the war. He often said that they were some of the very best students he had ever had because they had faced deep crises of both personal and huge collective suffering and meaninglessness. War is so often grossly and catastrophically meaningless, and they wanted to search for some kind of meaning in their lives and also devote themselves to something comprehensively serious and attentive to human needs.
Now, your father wrote the Serenity Prayer during World War II. He was very opposed to Hitler. His father had come to the United States from Germany in the 1800s. How did the war connect to his writing of the Serenity Prayer?
Well, that was the question I asked myself, and I ended up writing a book that's a good bit longer than I expected in order to arrive at the answer. It seems to me that this issue, the issue of what should be, what must be accepted as something that one cannot change, and what we must strive to improve or change or alter, and working at developing the wisdom to know the one thing from the other, that this way of looking at things had been sharply honed and developed and shaped during the years of the 1920s and 30s. In the 1920s, my father was a pastor in a working class and middle class congregation in Detroit, a city that was facing enormous social upheavals and difficulties with the development of the auto industries there. And in the 1930s, there was the Great Crash, and there was the rise of fascism and authoritarian and totalitarian regimes in Europe that threatened democracy and freedom everywhere. So the question of whether one opposed these developments and insisted that the drift toward accepting them be changed was an urgent one for him. So I think the formulation brings to a head his consideration of these anguished and difficult problems for more than 20 years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Elizabeth Sifton, and she's the vice president of the publishing company Farrar, Straus, Giroux. She's just written her first book, and it's called The Serenity Prayer, and it's about the prayer and the history of the prayer that was written by her father, the late theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. What really popularized the Serenity Prayer, and I think the reason why so many people know it today, is that it was adopted by Alcoholics Anonymous as a prayer for people who were struggling to overcome their drinking. And I think, you know, other groups have taken it on too, and now it's just become very widely known. How was it adopted by Alcoholics Anonymous?
I don't have the documentary paper trail on this. I only know, my father told me this, my mother repeated it, that at some point, I think in the late 40s, after the war, they simply wrote and asked him if they could use it, and he said sure. Similarly, Hallmark cards had also asked him if they could use it, and he had said sure. The fact that they simplified it, omitting the grace, for example, from the first sentence.
When so you say it, they, are you talking about AA?
They, AA, excuse yeah. me. I don't know whether they did that deliberately or it just happened. Prayers, after all, get spoken even more perhaps than they get read. And as they're passed around, they may just get a bit streamlined. But in any case, the AA version, which simply says, not give us, but give me serenity to accept the things that cannot be changed, et cetera, et cetera. They may have just done that in the course of things, not with a deliberate intention to alter it in any way.
It shocks me to hear that your father was willing to allow Hallmark to use the prayer for greeting cards. I mean, because that's in some ways, with no offense to Hallmark, but in some ways, everybody's worst fear is that like a wonderful piece of poetry or a profound literary statement will be used as like a little bumper sticker or a greeting card or something, and even though the words are the same, somehow it will be trivialized in that context.
I think he felt that yes, it might be and probably would be, but that it was not for him to determine that it should be controlled and kept pure or highbrow in some way. Mm-hmm. He didn't think of prayers like that. Prayers were written and composed and spoken from the heart for everyone, and one didn't control their use. Who was he to say how people would find it meaningful for them? So I think he just let it happen. That's very much part of his general ecumenical view that grace and serenity and courage and wisdom come to everyone in all walks of life in different parts of the world at different times. And it is not for him to say who should or should not use this prayer. He never, ever would have thought of copywriting it or asking for royalties on it, which often people jokingly say to me he should have done. It's an all-American thing, I suppose, to want to make money from anything one has done that has been in the least bit successful, but that would have appalled him.
So Hallmark never paid him for the use of the Serenity Prayer?
Not that I know of. They might have paid him a fee just at the beginning, but I don't know. That was in the 40s when I was a baby, and I don't actually know, and I have no record of it.
What are some of the most unusual or interesting contexts you've seen the Serenity Prayer used in or reprinted in?
Well, there are many kitschy versions. I mean, it's funny to find it on book plates or on coffee mugs. Well, of course, that's inevitable for, I suppose, in this day and age. I have a T-shirt with it on. But the most interesting, you asked, the most interesting I know about is not one that I've actually personally seen. But my friend Joseph Lelieveld of the New York Times, when he was correspondent for the New York Times in South Africa, saw the prayer quite often on a plaque hanging on a kitchen or living room wall in many black townships in Soweto and so on. And that moved me greatly to think, and it would have pleased my father to know that this prayer was of use to the black communities of South Africa in the terrible years of apartheid. But Joe also pointed out to me that he saw the prayer also on the walls of white supremacist apartheid supporters in South Africa, which suggests that whatever side you're on, you feel that it's appropriate for you.
My guest is Elizabeth Sifton. Her new book is called The Serenity Prayer, Faith and Politics in Times of Peace and War. The prayer is written by her father, the late theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. Sifton is a vice president of the publishing company Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is publisher and editor Elizabeth Sifton. She's written a new book about the Serenity Prayer, the prayer adapted by Alcoholics Anonymous, which was written by her father, the late theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. Her new book is called The Serenity Prayer, Faith and Politics in Times of Peace and War. You write about how one of the things that your father and many of his friends tried to puzzle through was where religion should fit in the public life of a country that was founded on the principle of separation of church and state. What were some of the ideas that your father had on that subject?
My father felt very strongly that the separation of church and state was an important and principle that must be attended to. More than saying what he thought the government should do about this, he was concerned with the health of the churches and the way the churches would approach this matter. He felt all too often that Protestant and Catholic and other clerics were hungry themselves for power and influence, and therefore compromised their distance from the powers that be by sucking up to them, by enjoying access to privilege and governmental power when they should keep their distance from it.
And it sounds like he also thought that the church should often challenge that power.
That's right. He felt that it was a part of the great Christian tradition to derive their understanding of the church's role in modern society the way the prophets in the Old Testament spoke of it, that there must be a distance kept from the temptations and evils of secular society, because secularism is evil. I mean the dangers of partisan and selfish and over-commercialized activities, the church should stay clear of these and not succumb to them. He also was very skeptical of ministers who became famous for their close association with political figures. He would say of them that they were always trembling on the abyss of exhibitionism. Exhibitionism is what many secular and agnostic and atheist people think that ministers first and foremost are. And I can't blame them.
Your father was critical in his time of both the left and the right. Can you describe what his criticisms of each were?
His criticism of the left, where he belonged himself, really, because he was a social progressive and cared tremendously for the issues of social justice and the betterment of all lives in any community, which I believe is a left position. His criticism of the left in the 20s and 30s and even into the 40s and 50s and 60s was that they tended to be cheerfully and rather stupidly optimistic about the chances for improvement and betterment, that they adopted what he called simplistic enlightenment ideas about progress of mankind, if only people are rational and good to each other and so on. And he thought the record of human history shows that this is absolutely not realistic, that there must be a deeper and better understanding of what makes people act the way they do and why there is so much evil and harm in the world must be interpreted in a more demanding and complicated way than many liberals did, who would just preach, I say preach even if they weren't ministers, preach self-improvement and betterment if only people were smarter or nicer or more rational or more sensible, or if only this would happen or that would happen. The most hubristic, simplistic attitude on the left that he deplored was, of course, the communist one. He was vehemently anti-communist on very Christian grounds. He thought it was a godless and hubristic idea to think that it was within the power of human beings to reorganize their society in such a way as to make everything come out right in the end, which the communists assured their followers their regimes could do. So that was his criticism of the left.
What about his criticism of the right?
His criticism of the right was deeper and more complete and more constant, because the right was so much in power and at the helm. Even during the New Deal, which challenged the right-wing orthodoxies of American economic life, he felt that wealthy and powerful people who control the levers of power and economic ownership of the means of production, to use the Marxist phrases, that these people had absolutely no regard, or very little regard, or insufficient regard for the welfare of everyone, and particularly of workers and of the less fortunate than they. That in a very big, dynamic, competitive, capitalist society like America, there was not any attention being paid on the right to the ordinary issues of social justice and economic fairness. He wrote somewhere that rich princes always imagine that they are wise. They imagine that they think they're wise because they're powerful and at the top of the heap, and it never occurs to them that they're only there because they have all the money, not because they are wiser than anyone else. So he inveighed constantly against the powers that be that he felt were unjust and indifferent to suffering.
My guest is Elizabeth Sifton. Her new book is called The Serenity Prayer. This is Fresh Air. We often talk about religion on Fresh Air, and we try to do it in a way that does not preach and that will be of interest to people of all faiths, as well as to people who do not practice any religion. If public radio sounds more reflective than other radio stations, it's because we don't have to play by the same commercial rules. We can, when we choose, be quiet, thoughtful, and challenging. And we could do it because you support us. I urge you to call now with a pledge. Thank you. My guest is publisher and editor Elizabeth Sifton. She's written a new book about the Serenity Prayer, the prayer adapted by Alcoholics Anonymous, which was written by her father, Reinhold Niebuhr. Your parents had an interfaith marriage. I mean, it wasn't totally interfaith, but it was mild on the scale of what interfaith means.
But, yes.
But your mother was Episcopalian, and your father's church was?
The Evangelical and Reformed Church, which was a small denomination founded by Germans in the 19th century and eventually merged with the Congregationalists, and they're now called the United Church of Christ.
Did your parents have disagreements about faith or about worship?
Not about faith, I think, but certainly about worship. They had quite strong disagreements about worship. My mother, as an Anglican, she was English and had been raised in the Anglican communion in England, was very liturgical. She believed in the great liturgy laid down in the Book of Common Prayer. My father was an evangelical. He believed that prayer and worship must come, as it were, spontaneous. You must open up your heart and spirit, and as the Spirit moves you, you pray. However, he greatly admired the liturgical communions, as he called it, the liturgical churches, for establishing a kind of discipline over these prayers, because he thought that it was important for ministers and the congregation to understand that prayers couldn't be and worship couldn't be a time for personal blandishments and show-off times, and that it was important to adhere to some sort of discipline of worship that the regular liturgies provided. However, in given instances, my father and my mother would argue about these things.
Did your mother find it strange that your father wrote prayers?
I think she thought it was dangerous.
Dangerous?
Well, I mean, yeah, dangerous because one could often just go off into he never did, of course. She deeply loved him and admired and loved him for his spiritual depth and precision of expression in his prayers. But I think she thought it was dangerous to just improvise prayers, because you could always make a fool of yourself. She was a rather stringent and caustic person in these matters.
Now, you write in your book that there was a period in your late adolescence when you had a crisis of faith. What was your crisis about?
My crisis was about, it came about at in a very simple way. I was attending, one summer, I was in England, and I attended a sung evensong, which is a very beautiful service, a daily service, sung by the choirs usually in the great cathedrals of England. And I was attending a sung evensong at Winchester Cathedral, where my parents had actually been married. And the church is sensationally beautiful, and the choir is very good, and the service was almost unbearably beautiful. And then I realized that I was worshiping the beauty of the service itself. I had become, as I said to my father later, a hellish aesthete. I was just enjoying the service for the service, and I wasn't really paying attention to the meaning of it. I have a feeling that this happens a lot in services of any kind that the congregants will enjoy. They're just enjoying the service more than they're thinking about what the service is for.
So it doesn't sound like it shattered your faith or anything.
Well, I thought to myself, I don't know if I believe this whole story. I don't know if I believe this man who, this itinerant rabbi in Palestine, was actually godly, a deity. I don't know if I believe any of this. I'm pretty sure I don't literally believe in the virgin birth. I'm not sure I literally believe in the resurrection. I'm not sure I believe in any of this. This is maybe, I've been sort of riding along on a tide of acceptance of something that I've known all my life, but that maybe it's all hooey. I was studying a lot of 18th century French Enlightenment thought at the time, and that, of course, encouraged me to be anti-clerical. But it just suddenly struck me as a kind of implausible story from the start, and I ought to distance myself from it. And so I did.
Where are you now on that?
Ambivalent. That is to say, I think of myself as a Christian, and I think of myself as a Protestant. I think of myself as somebody whose spiritual and intellectual life has been formed by an acceptance of the deep meaning of the stories in the Gospels. And I find them deeply beautiful and meaningful, and I think I believe them. But I, as I tried to write about, I was brought up to believe that accepting unbelief, accepting a difficulty in belief, was part of a true religious enterprise. That working at one's spiritual life is difficult, and there are many steps backward, and it's never easy. And so there are moments of lapses and moments of failure, and then you must try again. And so I had been taught that really good Christians accepted these failures and forgave you for them.
You are the vice president of Farrar, Straus, Giroux, the publishing house, and you've been in publishing your whole adult life. This is the first book you've written, and I guess I'm wondering why it's taken you so long to write a book.
Oh, because I didn't have time to write a book. Helping others get their books published was more than enough work for me, and I also didn't have a subject that I wanted to write about. When I was in college, I studied both history and literature. I never focused on one historical or political issue or type of work, nor did I with literary work. And it's been a joy for me as a publisher to work in both fields. And I'm a generalist. I never had a particular subject I wanted to write about. But then, wishing to clarify the history of this beautiful prayer and its enormous popularity gave me my subject. So I wrote it then. It's an amazing thing to write a book after you've helped so many other people see a book being published. It's very different from the other side of the desk, I'll tell you.
What are some of the differences?
Well, here's a very simple one. If a writer gives me, as an editor, a manuscript to look at, and I say I'll get to it right away, I mean that I'll get to it within the week, right? Or as soon as I can, and there are 55 million other things I've got to do. Of course, I know that every writer wants to be thought of as the editor's sole responsibility for the moment, but I always tried to say, listen, I'm not sure I can read that till next Tuesday, you know, and then the writer would say, oh yes, I understand that. Well, as a writer, I cannot understand why people don't call me within 20 minutes of reading my book. the 24 hours maximum. That's one example. The writing and editing of it was not so different in a way. The late Laurie Colwin, who is a friend and colleague of mine, said once when asked the same question about writing and editing and the differences, she said that she always looked at other people's prose as if it were her own and addressed the editorial problems with care as if they were her own. But she tried to read her own prose as if it was somebody else's, ruthlessly, you know? And I tried to do the same.
Elizabeth Sifton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Elizabeth Sifton's new book is called The Serenity Prayer. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
My buddies tell me.
A new CD pays tribute to the Leuven Brothers, the country music singers who wrote the song I Like the Christian Life. It was introduced to rock listeners on the Bird CD, Sweethearts of the Rodeo, which has just been reissued. On the next Fresh Air, an interview with Charlie Leuven. Join us.